This conference will now be recorded.
All right, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the July 21st, 2022 Citizens Ethics Advisory Board meeting. First item of business is to take attendance. Nichelle Mullen.
Look at her face.
There she is. She was unmuting. We know she's here. Mary Bigelow.
Love that smile, Nichelle.
Charles Trussano.
Present.
There he is. Hi, Charles. Karen Christiana.
Here.
Karen's here by phone. Thank you, Karen. Jason will not be here with us today, and Kevin will not be here with us today. Cheryl Lipson, we see her there. Hi, Cheryl. And Laura Schuyler. There we go. All right, thank you, folks. So the first item of business, as always, is to approve the June 16th, 2022 regular meeting minutes. Can I get a motion to approve?
So moved.
All right. Well, thank you. So Charles moved. I think Nichelle seconded. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstaining?
Cheryl.
We have one abstention, and that's Cheryl Lipson. All right, that motion passes. Thank you. We next need an approval of the June 22nd special meeting minutes for the Subcommittee on Municipal Ethics, and this is to be voted on just by the members of the Municipal Ethics Subcommittee group. Can I get a motion to approve those minutes?
So moved, Cheryl.
Cheryl, second?
Second.
Thank you, Charles. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you. All right, and so for my report, just as a reminder, we don't do a UAPA hearing in August. We have one coming up in September. So I will need a hearing officer for September 8th. My calendar is available on that day. So I'm happy to take it unless somebody else has a burning desire. I haven't done my hearing officer duties in a long time. So, and I know that Charles has done quite a few, so.
I'm available.
What's that, Cheryl?
I'm available.
You're very kind. How about we'll put you as backup? Because okay. I know you've done several as well. So I'll take September 8th. And then the next item that we have to discuss is that it's nominating committee time. And I can't believe it's been a year since we last did this. So we need to appoint a nominating committee that has to be composed of at least two members of the board who are not interested in the position of chair or vice chair to meet and meet with Peter before the August meeting so that they can present a slate at the upcoming August meeting. And Peter, they present the slate at the August meeting or at the September meeting?
The August, according to the policy number one, it says at the regular August meeting, the nominating committee shall present a list of candidates to the full board.
Okay, and then but the election would happen in September.
The election can happen in September, correct. Yeah.
Okay, very good. Thank you for that clarification. Do we have any volunteers to be on the nominating committee? Well, thank you, Mary.
I have no problem being, I would be happy to be on the committee. I'm supposed to be out of town on August 18th, though, which is, I believe, our next meeting. So if that presents a problem, I will withdraw my name.
I don't think it presents a problem to participate on the committee if you won't be at the next meeting, right, Peter?
That's correct. So, yeah. For example, the nominating committee can meet before August 18th. Someone from the committee can present the list of candidates to be presented to the board. So Cheryl,
and I saw Charles raise his hand as well. Charles, you want in on this committee as well?
Three people.
At least two, but I mean, we can have more than earlier. So it's We can have three as well. The executive director serves as ex officio, but yeah, Charles, Cheryl, if anyone else wants to.
And Mary, right? Mary.
And Mary.
That's so fine. Charles, Cheryl, and Mary, that sounds like a good group.
Of course.
All right, good. We need a vote to establish the committee.
Yes. Yep.
So can I get a motion to establish the nominating committee to be comprised of Mary, Cheryl, and Charles?
I'll move. I'll move.
You get a second? Thank you, Michelle.
Second.
Thank you, Karen. That was Karen on the second. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Abstaining? That motion passes. Thank you very much, folks. I don't have anything else, but the next thing that's on our agenda is Brian's presentation of the outside employment provisions. And Peter and I were discussing earlier, it's up to the board whether you want to do that today or if you want to do that in August. I'll note today we're missing Jason and Kevin, and so it's probably worthwhile asking who may not be present in August so we can make sure that we have the most number of folks present. So Cheryl won't be here in August. Is anybody else not planning on being around in for the August meeting? All right. So
Dina, if I can just jump in briefly, Brian just told me he will be on vacation the week of the August 18th board meeting. So
well, then that decides it, folks. So Peter, we should check with him first, huh?
Unless Peter wants to do it.
I can do it, but Brian will do a better job.
All right. Well, then why don't we do that? I mean, are you prepared and ready, Brian? I'm sure you are.
Absolutely.
All right, let's go ahead and do that presentation then. Are you gonna have the slides on the screen here for us, or should we open the document that was sent?
We'll put it up on the screen. I believe Melissa can do that,
right? Very good. All right, I turn it over to you, Brian.
To do it.
Go to the P.
Here we go.
Perfect.
Can probably close those. Oh, that will do. Yeah. You can close the settings, but don't close that because that will disconnect. Yeah. Here you go. Yeah. Perfect.
So we're good.
I think, can everyone see the screen?
Yep. Okay, I assume everybody can see the screen at this point?
They can't hear us.
Can you hear us?
All their mics are off. Maybe ask them again. Can you hear us?
Our mic. What about our
mics? Mics are off.
Well, they put themselves on mute.
Yeah. Yeah. Can you hear us?
We can hear you.
Oh, okay.
I can hear you.
Okay. All right. So today we're going to do the outside employment presentation. Outside employment rules are some of the absolute worst to deal with because we have such vague language that we're dealing with in the code. And we'll jump right in there. Generally, the slideshow for outside employment is about four slides during a general presentation. But given the fact that this is for the board, I'm going to try to go into some more detail here and go over some things that we don't normally give people during one of our general presentations. So Melissa, if you could just move along to the first slide. Previous one, that's the second one. There we go. So you'll see on here, we have two main outside employment rules, 1-84B and 1-84C. And 1-84B is the primary outside employment provision. And what it says is basically you can't do two things. A state employer, public official may not accept outside employment that either impairs their independence of judgment as to their state duties or that would induce disclosure of confidential information. Now, before getting into, you know, what independence of judgment is, I'm going to define a few terms here. The first one you'll see there is except. So this actually comes up a lot. If you look at the language, it says no state employer or public official shall accept outside employment, et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of times we'll get calls from an agency saying, you know, we just hired this employee and it turns out they have this outside job that they brought, that they had prior to coming to state service. And my answer to them is, well, there's nothing we can do about that because the prohibition here doesn't kick in until you're a state employee. So once you're a state employer, public official, then the prohibition on accepting outside employment kicks in. So if someone has a pre-existing employment relationship, i.e. it pre-exists their state employment, technically this provision would not bar that outside employment. And what we say to the agencies is, well, you have to determine whether you want to allow the person to have the job. If you determine it's a problem, you can tell them they can't do it. There's just nothing under the code that would allow us to prohibit that employment. So again, that's the first thing. That's what accept means. Next is the term employment, and the regulations define it very broadly. You'll see there any work or endeavor, whatever it's in form, undertaken to obtain financial gain. And the regulations give examples of an employee of a business, a sole practitioner, an independent contractor, an investor. Because a lot of times somebody will call up and say, well, I'm not employed by this entity, you know, I'm an independent contractor. And we tell them, no, the definition is much broader. Employment would include something like that. So again, very broad definition of employment. The last term I want to talk about is induced to disclose. That second prohibition, and we get questions about this sometimes, what does that mean? So you can't accept outside employment in which you'd be induced to disclose confidential information. And the best advisory opinion that I found that talks about this is one dealing with a secretary who was employed at a state regulatory agency, and she was the one who had access to this calendar. And the agency would go on unannounced inspections of hospitals. And she wouldn't do it. She wasn't involved in regulating. But she had access to this confidential calendar that announced that all the dates of the unannounced inspections of hospitals. She wanted to go work for a hospital. And the commission said, no, you have access to that calendar. You may be induced to hand over that information about when they're going to be inspected, and therefore it would be barred under 1-84B. So that's what that language induced to disclose confidential information means. Now, next you'll notice we have our 1-84C. This is the other main outside employment rule. Again, very broad language. You can't use your state position or state office to obtain financial gain for yourself or any of your family members. For a business with which you're associated. Also, you can't use confidential information for the benefit of any of those individuals or any businesses. So those comprise the two main rules. So we'll move on to the next slide. And luckily, our regulations, the previous one, our regulations provide a little more meat to what those provisions mean. The first thing they say is it's permissible for a state employer official to use their expertise, even expertise gained in state service. That's okay. You can do that for personal financial gain unless you're violating a code provision. And obviously that's where it becomes tricky. But then the regulations go on to talk about when it's a violation of 1-84B and C. And what it says is those provisions are generally violated when someone accepts outside employment with an individual or entity that can benefit from their state position or their state actions. And the example they give, and you'll see that at the bottom, if the individual in his or her state capacity has specific regulatory, contractual, or supervisory authority over the private person. You know, a very simple example, you know, if Mark came up to me and said, hey, Brian, I'd like to go and engage in outside employment at Sullivan & Lachine, you know, a communicator lobbyist, a business org, I would say absolutely not. You have regulatory authority over them, and therefore it would impair your independence of judgment and also could be use of office. Therefore, you can't do it. So very basic kind of situation. Another one, you know, say we had a contract with a company to work on our computer system, and Peter came to me and said, hey, Brian, I'd like to go engage in outside employment with that that company. Well, he has contractual authority over that company, so he couldn't do that. So those are just a few examples of what would be considered, you know, independence of judgment violations or use of office violations. So moving on to the next slide, over the years, the former commission and this agency have kind of developed some rules that stem from 1-84 B and C. And these are kinds of the rules that we go over with people when they call us requesting advice on outside employment. And we phrase these as questions. For example, you know, the first one, you may not accept outside employment in an area or industry over which you have regulatory authority. So we would say, do you have, you know, any regulatory authority over this area or industry, et cetera. And we ask all these questions and they give us answers that helps us kind of craft an answer. But again, some of these rules, that first one we just already talked about, if you have regulatory authority over a specific individual or entity, well, generally you shouldn't be accepting outside employment with that person. The next one, you may not, a state employee or public official, may not be paid privately to do what is essentially already required to do as part of their state job. So a good example would be, for example, I'm giving a presentation today on ethics. Now, say, for example, that a bunch of lobbyists were like, hey, Brian, can you come give a presentation for us? And I wanted to do that in my outside capacity and get paid for it. Well, that's already part of my state job, and they could get that for free here. So I can't kind of compete with the state and go get offer my services for compensation. And this actually comes up quite a bit in that context. We get questions from trainers at various state agencies, and they train on certain things that are the subject of their agency's jurisdiction. And then they call us and ask if they can go to train that community that they deal with. And we're like, well, no, it's if it's part of your state job to do it, then that would be problematic. So the next rule is very, very commonplace, and you may not use state resources, time, materials, or personnel to further outside employment. You'd be surprised how often this comes up in enforcement actions. I think everyone recalls the Dickman matter, where you had a state employee who was running two state businesses out of her state office using state computers, state time, state, you know, state telephone lines, all kinds of stuff. So that's one of the most basic rules we try to tell everyone, especially in this age of telecommuting, you know, you got to be very careful. The next one here is dealing with the use of your state title. Again, another use of office issue. So when people, for example, have their outside businesses, we always tell them, you know, you can't use your state title in the context of any advertising materials, any publications for your business. If you're handing out business cards to people and it also happens to have your state position on there, that's a problem. So any kind of advertisement, we distinguish between resumes. You know, we never would prohibit somebody from putting their state title on a resume or in kind of biographical stuff. You know, a lot of legislators, if you look on their websites, a lot of them are attorneys. And in the biography section, they have, you know, work in the legislature. So again, we're not focused here on kind of that kind of biographical stuff, resumes. It's more in your advertising for your business and your employment. And that's where this prohibition would come in. So we'll move to the next one. This next one's pretty straightforward. Again, you may not, a state employee may not, actually one more, may not attempt to drum up business from contacts made in state service or to exploit contacts to benefit their outside employment. Again, when you're interacting with people in your state capacity, you shouldn't be pushing your outside business on them. Very straightforward. The next one, may not accept outside employment where the state position lends credence to his private practice, which does not arise from his expertise alone. So that language stems from an old advisory opinion where you had an individual who was an attorney who was a member of some state board that had a regulatory authority, and the individual wanted to represent clients before the agency on matters that potentially would come up to the board. And the commission said, no, you just can't do that, because while you may have expertise, the fact that you're on that board, which has jurisdiction over everything you're involved in, would lend credence to your private practice. You know, so again, you have potential independence of judgment issues for that person in their board capacity, potential use of office. The person might hire them because they say, hey, that person's on the board, why wouldn't I hire them? So again, that's another issue that we that comes up occasionally. And the last one we have here is a state employee may not accept outside employment that would interfere with their ability to devote the requisite time and energy to their state job, which must always take precedence. So what we tell people is you know, assuming that the other rules aren't violated, we end with this and say, your state job has to take precedence. If your other job's going to interfere with your state job to the extent that you can't perform your responsibilities, that would be an independence of judgment issue, and it would be a violation of the code. So, you know, if we also say if someone wants to take the occasional vacation day because they want to work their outside job, maybe here or there, okay, well, you know, that's not necessarily going to be deemed a violation. But it's when it becomes so much that they really aren't getting their job done. And that's when that rule would be triggered. So those are some of the rules. So now we have the statute, the regulation, the rules. And what I wanted to finish off here with the main outside employment rules are some examples. And I pulled a bunch of examples. I'll go through them quickly. But I find out this is the best way to kind of, you know, get a grasp around these provisions is to kind of find out how they've been played out in certain contexts. So you see the first one here, you had an employee at the Department of Health Services who was steering members of the public seeking asbestos removal to a company with which he had a financial interest. So people were calling into the agency and saying, hey, you know, I need asbestos removal. Can you recommend anybody? And he was recommending a company that he had a financial arrangement with. He was employed by that company. Obvious violation of the code. The next one, we had an individual, a supervisor in the vital records division of the Department of Health Services, who was researching information concerning vital records, which the person had access to by virtue of the state position. So this is confidential information. And then they were selling it to a private company for financial gain. And again, this gets back to the whole use of officer financial gain. You can't do it. Pretty straightforward violation. Next page. So then, the chief maintenance employee at a state prison was referring private business to a subcontractor performing work under his state supervision. So this individual had a state contractor that he was working with, and apparently the state contractor needed some help in some capacity. And the individual who was supervising that state contract said, oh, well, I have a business that can do that. Just give me a call on the outside. Again, a use of office, potential independence of judgment issue also. Next one, we have a DOC, Department of Correction officer, who was also a private attorney, and apparently he was providing legal representation to inmates under the jurisdiction of DOC, including representing them in actions against his very agency. So all kinds of issues there, independence of judgment, use of office issues. You know, they might choose him because he kind of, you know, is overseeing him. He may treat people differently if he's representing them in court. All kinds of issues there under both provisions. The next one, we had an employee of the Department of Veterans Affairs Hospital who was involved in purchasing communications equipment from a private entity while at the same time was working as a salesperson for that entity. So, you know, obviously his independence of judgment was impaired, likely to go to the business that's paying you on the outside. We just have two more on the next slide. And the next one's similar. We had a dean at Central Connecticut State University who was managing a partnership between the university and a private hospital. And at the same time, the private hospital was paying him for providing consulting services, but it was unrelated. It had nothing to do with the state service, or the state work, but that really doesn't make a difference. His oversight over this entity, his judgment is being impaired because they're paying him. So he might look at them differently by virtue of the fact they're writing him a check. And the last one is something that comes up relatively often, similar situations. At the Department of Revenue Service, we had an employee whose job it was to review tax returns, and he was being paid by, I think it was H&R Block, a tax preparation service, a firm, to prepare state and federal tax returns on behalf of the company's clients. So the very, you know, he was in a state capacity reviewing these forms, but also in his outside capacity, he was being paid to submit them. So when he's reviewing a form, he may say, oh, well, wait a minute, this person did this in the form, but I did that too when I submitted one. So I'm going to say this is okay just because I did it out there. And I'm, you know, so again, major independence of judgment issues. Also, it's likely that H&R Block would love somebody from DRS to be working for them. So you have use of office issues also. So those are just it's kind of a quick overview of the main outside employment provisions. If anybody has any questions, let me know. Otherwise, I'll move on to the next provision, which doesn't necessarily come up as much, but it's good to know about. 1-84D. Again, this is an outside employment rule. It doesn't apply to that many people. Generally, you know, people who have to worry about this are the lawyers, the accountants, you know, environmental engineers, people like that. But there's two prohibitions in this provision. First, what it says is a state employer, public official, may not represent others for compensation before 11 state regulatory agencies. And that's not the exact language it uses, but it's very long, so I kind of condensed it. So again, in my, you know, I'm an attorney, and if in my outside capacity, I wanted to go represent a client before one of those 11 agencies, and they include like insurance department, Department of Banking, Connecticut Siting Council. So if somebody wanted to hire me in my outside capacity to represent them before the insurance department, I couldn't do it. I'd be barred by that provision, even though I have nothing to do with the insurance department. It's just a blanket rule for all state employees. And if you note down there, represent is defined very broadly. You can't do anything that would reveal your identity. So I couldn't submit a document with my name on it. I couldn't make a phone call on their behalf. I couldn't show up in person. As long as I'm being compensated, it is problematic under that provision. So that's the first prohibition. The second one says, no state employer, public official may be a member or employee of an entity that is in the business of representing others for compensation before any of those 11 state regulatory agencies. So again, this applies to law firms, accounting firms, engineering firms, firms and entities that are in the business of representing others, as opposed to itself, before these 11 state regulatory agencies. So going back to the example of me, if I wanted to go work for a law firm X in my outside capacity, and that law firm had a practice that represented people before the insurance department, I couldn't even go work there. Not only could I not do the work myself, but I couldn't even work for that firm. It would be a violation of that provision. And when it talks about entities that are in the business of representing others for compensation, it's limited to these business forms: partnerships, associations, professional corporations, and sole proprietorships. So that's the kind of the universe of the provision, the entities that I'd be barred from going to work for. Now, the last thing you'll note there, it says doesn't apply to an entity that represents itself. So if I wanted in my outside capacity to go work for a corporation or a union or a municipality that would occasionally represent itself before one of those agencies, but they don't represent others, then I could go work there. That's perfectly fine. I wouldn't violate the second thing. But under the first rule, I wouldn't be able to represent that entity before any of those 11 regulatory agencies. So again, it's kind of a tricky provision just because the language is just so long. On the next slide, I want to talk about some exceptions, because even some members of the board might be freaking out right now if you happen to work for a law firm and are like, wait a minute, my law firm has a group that represents clients before these agencies. Am I in trouble? So there are various exceptions here. And you note the first one, which will apply to you guys. If you're a board member who receives no compensation other than per diem payments or reimbursement for actual expenses, e.g., members of this board, you guys would fit right there, then the restrictions here do not apply to you. Also, the restrictions don't apply to members or directors of quasi-public agencies. Again, these are unpaid people, so they don't want to put this kind of stringent prohibition on them. And the last exception deals with teaching and research professional employees at basically the state universities. I'll note in the bottom, legislators have a special exception, and throughout the code, you'll find that in certain circumstances, they do have this exception, and they're not subject to the second prohibition about being employees or members of these entities that appear represented others before these agencies, provided two things. So they can go work for those entities like a law firm, but they can take no part in any matter involving the agency, and they can receive no compensation. And as long as they abide by those two, they can go work for any entity that represents others before those 11 state regulatory agencies. So moving on, I'm going to move to another provision. It's not necessarily our outside employment provision, but it comes up in the context of outside employment. It's our contracting with the state provision.
Can't hear anything.
Thank you, guys. Muted.
Okay.
What was that?
They're probably trying to enter.
Oh, okay. And you'll see there what open and public process means. There's two things: that you have to have prior public offer, and then you have to have subsequent public disclosure of all proposals considered and the contract awarded. What this is intended to prohibit is for state employees and public officials to get the inside track on state contracts, to somehow be able to use their positions to get that contract before a member of the public would have the opportunity to bid. And you look at the bottom, so the process here has to allow for all or most of those persons interested in and qualified to fill the contract to apply and complete. Like in the past, the advertisement would have to go in like a newspaper of major circulation, something like that. Now it's sufficient under the prior public offer section for the contract to be offered on the agency's state website and on the Department of Administrative Services procurement website. And as long as it's on those two websites, the contract would be deemed open and public, and therefore, you know, a state employer, public official would be able to bid on that contract. Okay, next slide, please. Now, under that provision, it's permissible for a state employer, public official to contract with their own state agency. There's no bar there, except one thing. The executive head of an agency may not, nor his family members, nor an associated business of that executive head can contract with their own agency. So for example, with us, Peter could never contract with the Office of State Ethics, nor could his immediate family, nor could any associated business of his. That's a complete and absolute bar. Anybody else can, but obviously other rules can kick in, like use of office. You have to make sure you have nothing to do with it, et cetera. Now, you'll note that there's another thing down here. This does not apply to unpaid board or commission members. Again, that's you guys. This prohibition does not apply unless you have authority or control over the subject matter of the contract. So if Charles wanted to, has a side outside business, and he wanted to contract with another state agency to do that, that would not be a problem under this provision. But if he wanted a contract with the Office of State Ethics, and it was a contract over which the board has jurisdiction, subject matter over the subject matter, then he would not be able to do it unless it went through an open and public process. So that's the gist of 184I. I gave a few examples on the next slide. And I noted when I was going through the examples that they all deal with universities. A lot of universities apparently have some issues with this. So you have the first one, an employee of the art department at Western Connecticut State University owned an art studio and contracted with the university to sell art supplies without an open and public process. The next one, an immediate family member of a Central Connecticut State University employee contracted with the university to provide videography services without that process. And the third one is another Western Connecticut employee entering into a contract with various departments at the university to tune and service their pianos without that open and public process. And each one of them was the subject of an enforcement action. I know there was another one where you had an individual who, I think they offered, what is it called, DJ services. And the university just asked him, hey, we hear that you provide DJ service. Can you DJ this party for us? And he said, sure. Not knowing about this prohibition, he did it. It was for a few hundred dollars. But he was the subject of an enforcement action. So a lot of times people get tripped up on this one, just not knowing it exists. We try to let as many people know as possible, but it is, you know, seems to happen at the universities quite a bit. Now, I'm almost done, I promise. Two more topics, and I'll go through relatively quickly. Legislators outside employment. So legislators are subject to a different standard, and it's not in the statute or regulations. It's all created by virtue of the virtue of advisory opinions. So you won't find anything in 184B or C that accepts them or exempts them. Technically, the same rules apply. But as you'll note here in this language, the former commission would said that it's really hard to apply these provisions to members of the part-time General Assembly. The majority of them have to have outside employment, given the fact that it's part-time, and potential conflicts are inevitable. So what they said is, if we started applying the same rules to them as we apply to state employees, 90% of them are going to have to leave their jobs, and therefore we'd be in trouble here. So there's a lesser standard applied to them. So if you can move to the next slide, Melissa. So you'll see there's basically a presumption in favor of legislators outside employment. As a matter of fact, the former executive director of the State Ethics Commission said that, you know, we grant them a maximum degree of latitude in their outside employment. And they prohibit outside employment only in the most significant conflicts. So there have been, since 1977, I believe, 29 formal rulings, advisory opinions and declaratory rulings. And there have only been 5 conflicts with outside employment and legislators that have been deemed significant. One of them involved a legislator who wanted to basically be paid to report on the activities of the legislature. So he was going to write for some paper on what was going on with the legislature. They said, no, you can't do that. All the other ones, the four other ones, and the handful of informal opinions where we've said, no, you can't do this, they all involve committee chairs. So that's the one group of legislators where the former commission and this board have said, you know, if you're a committee chair, then you cannot accept outside employment in an industry over which your committee has cognizance or jurisdiction. Just given the fact that they wield so much authority, there's kind of a blanket rule that you just can't accept outside employment in that industry. There is one other opinion that deals with the Speaker of the House. Generally, the leaders, like the Speaker and the House Majority Leader, and the head of the Senate, with the Senate Majority Leader, they haven't been held to the same standard as the committee chairs. But there is one opinion where the Speaker of the House, I believe it was Jim Amon at the time, he was barred from engaging in certain activity as a fundraiser on behalf of the MS Society, where he was soliciting lobbyists. There was an opinion in 2007 that said that's going too far. So that's the one other legislator beside the committee chairs where they kind of put the kibosh on his outside employment. So that's it for legislators. And the last slide I'm going to talk about is state supervisors and subordinates, and I'll be very quick here. An advisory opinion that was issued by this board back in 2005, basically what it says is, a state supervisor can't hire a subordinate in their outside business. And you flip that, a state subordinate can't employ a supervisor in the subordinate's outside business. So again, if Peter had an outside business mowing lawns and he came out to me and, hey, Brian, you want to work for me? That's a problem under the code. If I had a business and I went to Peter and said, hey, Peter, you want to work for me? Again, that's a problem. There's obvious independence of judgment issues. Peter might treat me differently based on what's going on in our outside capacity. If I'm doing a great job and for his outside business, he might treat me great or treat me better than others. If I'm doing a terrible job, he might treat me differently in my state capacity. So, same thing other way around there. So again, that's just a general rule that we've applied. Doesn't come up too often, but again, supervisors and subordinates can't employ each other. That is it. I hope I didn't take too long, and I know I went quick, but if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions? Go ahead, Laura.
Question out of curiosity, are probate court judges subject to these rules?
No. Probate court judges are not. Yeah, no judges are subject to the code.
Any other questions for Brian? Thank you for that very thorough and helpful presentation. We do appreciate getting all this good education from you all. We read every month the summary of the verbal and written advice that you give to folks, and this helps with context. So thank you for that. Brian, can we stick with you and move to the next item on the agenda, which is consideration of the petition for declaratory ruling from Michael Festa?
Yes, I really don't have much to say here. I'm sure you all took a look at it, and it is just way outside our jurisdiction. There's nothing here that touches upon any code provision or any of the regulations. So therefore, I recommend that the board deny the petition because it has nothing to do with this.
Any questions for Brian on that petition that was in our board packet? On the advice of our counsel here, can we get a motion to, I completely agree with your advice, Brian, and I'll ask for a motion to deny the declaratory ruling petition from Michael Festa. Can I get a second for that motion?
So moved.
Okay. I guess I need someone to officially make it. So, Charles, are you making that motion? Then we'll have Laura second it.
I'm making that motion.
Okay, Laura, you'll second that for us. Thank you. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Abstaining? That motion passes. Thank you for your analysis of that, Brian. And we'll stay with you for the legal division report.
I don't have too much to add, just two minor things. One, with respect to the petition for declaratory ruling that I mentioned at the bottom of the report with the MDC, we have not received that. I know Peter spoke with somebody who said they were going to be submitting it, and they were going to try to be submitting it before this meeting. We haven't received it. If we do get it before the next meeting, what we'll try to do is not only present the petition, but also present a draft advisory opinion, because we'd have plenty of time if they get it in relatively soon. So again, we're still waiting on that. The other thing I would mention is, I didn't mention it in here in the report, but we have not received anything from the Attorney General's office with respect to the matter involving the Connecticut Port Authority and whether the mayor of Bridgeport has to file an SFI for being a member of that board. So we're still waiting on that. I don't have anything else. If you have any questions, just let me know.
Go ahead, Michelle.
I have a question. Brian, on your report, page 7, R-A-O-T 19523.
Sorry about that. Not 523?
Yep, 523.
Okay, yeah.
How could that be possible? I'm just like really intrigued, because it just seems like that's a way for any public official who's subject to the code to circumvent the code.
So under the code is only concerned with gifts coming in. So obviously if lobbyists and state contractors are giving gifts to the governor, that's clearly problematic. But there's no provision in the code that would bar a public official like the governor or any other public official state employee giving gifts to anybody else, whether it's a restricted donor or non-restricted donor. There's simply no provision that would touch that.
Wow. Okay.
And that question honestly does come up quite a bit. We always get questions about, you know, legislators wanting to kind of go out to a meal with a lobbyist, and they're like, can I pay for them? And from a technical standpoint, yeah, there's no code provision that would bar it. We do tell people there could be appearance issues, but we simply have no jurisdiction over them.
Wow. It just seems so weird. Okay, well, thank you for that.
Sure.
Any other questions for Brian? And I will say, Brian, while you've had a chance to have a little bit of a breather this month, it's still read like a really busy month.
It's pretty busy.
Just reading. All right, Mark Wasilewski for the Enforcement Division report.
Yes, thank you, Chair Castrico. Hello, Board. A few notes to highlight from the enforcement report. First of all, we've completed the initiative to enforce the late statements of financial interest. We've rolled down into the enforcement of the second quarter ETH 2Ds and 2Cs, which are the lobbyist reports, the quarterly lobbyist reports. In between those two initiatives, the division resolved a docket number 2020-15 for $10,000. This is a pretty substantial penalty. A company that was seeking to do business or doing business, depending on the time period, with the Port Authority had given a few gifts to staff there and as well as a board member. And we prosecuted them. They cooperated fully to their credit and have paid a $10,000 fine. Aside from this, the division remains very active. And if you have any questions about the enforcement report, I'll be happy to address.
Thanks for that, Mark, and for you and your division's work on the Seabury matter, the enforcement matter. If there are no questions for Mark, I think we can move on to the audit report. So we've got the audit for Connecticut Center for Advanced Technology. So Mark Creighton.
Good morning, members. As you see in your packet, there are two findings. One was they overstated payments to their communicator in 2019 by $2,000. And then in 2020, they understated payments to their communicator by $4,000. In both instances, they have amended their filings to correct the overstatement and the understatement. And I'm happy to answer any questions if there are any.
Does anyone have any questions for Mark? And I'll just say we've lost the video feed again for the conference room.
Oh.
I assume it was just a timing issue, they weren't paying attention?
Yeah, they didn't provide any written response. You know, they seemed to be aware of it when I spoke to them regarding the findings. You know, they were kind of already aware of it, so. That's that.
Anything else for Mark? All right, can I get a motion to approve the audit report for Connecticut Center for Advanced Technology?
I'm moved.
Thank you, Charles. Can I get a second?
Second, Cheryl.
Thank you, Cheryl. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstaining? That motion passes. Thank you, Mark. Peter, will you take us through the education communications report? I know it's a little, the education, a little lighter this month.
Sure. Thank you. Again, good afternoon, everyone. You have a copy of the report. As it's noted, during the summer months, June through August, and this year is no exception, the trainings are lighter. We only have two this month. And it's usually to the fact that agencies do not schedule many of these because a lot of folks are on vacation. So, and that's one of the, definitely the principal reason why it's lighter on the education front. We are in the process of scheduling in-person training. Actually, one is scheduled in September for the Office of Early Childhood. We are also scheduling for the legislative staff, the entire legislative staff in the General Assembly. And I'm already working, I'm in the process of working with the legislative management to schedule trainings for members of the General Assembly, the mandatory trainings that occur every 4 years. The last one was held in 2019, during the 2019 legislative session, and the plan is to do the same in the upcoming 2023 legislative session to provide ethics training to all members of the General Assembly. I would like to thank Brian for handling the outside employment presentation at this meeting. We have one more scheduled, and most likely in September or October, we'll cover the Code of Ethics for Lobbyists. Even though you're not subject to it, well, at least you're subject by gifts provisions, but at least as regulators, I think it would be good to have a detailed discussion of the Code of Ethics for Lobbyists, which obviously is important. And finally, I just want to thank Diane for preparing this month's media report. We thought it would be very light, but contrary to that, it's been pretty busy, pretty active, both not only in Connecticut, but also elsewhere around the country. So thank you, Diane, for that. That's it on the education report. I can jump into my executive director's report if you have any questions, unless you have questions about the education component.
Go ahead, unless anyone's got questions.
Okay. So in my report, I want to start with personnel. Again, our arduous journey to fill the director of education and communications position. I continue to work with Colleen Murphy, my counterpart at Freedom of Information Commission, to reclassify the position. DAS, we submitted specs. DAS came back to us with a good draft of reconfigured position that we proposed. So we were moving in the right direction. Although the reconfigured position description, that is taking us closer to our desired goal, the outstanding issue is that of salary for this managerial position. We're in discussions about.
Oh, I think we lost your audio again. We lost your audio.
Okay.
Now you're back. I can hear you now. I don't know what keeps triggering over there, but we can hear you now.
We evidently have some internet connection issues here. Melissa just informed me, so hopefully If you lose me or anyone, just signal to us, so we'll stop and hopefully.
Okay.
All right. So again, my hope is that this will move along fairly quickly and that we'll come to an agreement with DAS and finally have our position ready to be advertised. Again, my strong desire is to do this in early fall, so we're ready to move along on the education and communications front. Also, on the personal front, I just wanted to give you an update on refilling Mike Morrissey's vacancy with his retirement. As of July 1st, I commenced the process to refill his position. As you may recall, over the past few months, we anticipated that Mike's vacancy, or we anticipated Mike's departure, and that his vacancy would be filled with that of a legal investigator. We obviously, knowing that he was leaving, we wanted to have a seamless transition in a legal or enforcement investigations in that realm. And that's why we hired early on, we hired Garrett Kelly. And that transition has been very smooth. But the idea was to, well, once Mike leaves, is to hire another legal investigator to help not only with investigations, but also address the issue of outstanding audits. We only conduct 10, as you know, Mark Creighton is working on them. But really, that's a long neglected area that we really need to address. And Mark and I, Mark Wasilewski and I, had conversations that probably the best way to address these issues is to hire an accounts examiner or associate accounts examiner instead of a legal investigator, and address the need for increased audits, not only on the lobbyist front, to increase them up to 40. We're authorized by regulations to conduct 40 annual audits, but also to do SFI, random SFI audits, to also provide help with generating reports for enforcement and analysis of financial documents for enforcement purposes. So we're still considering this to be somewhat a hybrid position, but with a greater focus on audits. And that individual, the associate's accounts examiner, would provide help to a legal investigator and to attorneys in the analysis of financial documents whenever necessary. So we're still treating this as somewhat a hybrid position. Keep in mind, we used to have an associate's accounts examiner position up until 2011. George Edelman used to hold that position. We lost that position because of the budget cuts and consolidation, the unfortunate consolidation to the Office of Governmental Accountability. Charles knows the history of that very well. And so we are, in essence, rebuilding. But I think, again, having that conversation with Mark, I think we will be better served of hiring an accounts examiner who will help out, will not only address the audits, but also help out in investigations when necessary, particularly doing a good forensic accounting investigations of financial documents, reviewing financial documents, and so on. So that's the goal. The ball is already rolling. We've already received an approval from DAS. And the only outstanding approval that has to take place is by OPM, which I anticipate and I hope this will be done fairly soon and no later than the end of July, so we can advertise for this position sometime in August and have someone on board, hopefully in September, so we can get ready for when we conduct the lottery of lobbyists. We can increase the number of the lobbyist audits going forward. So that's on personnel front. Changing gears, we have we're planning to do updates to our lobbyist and SFI forms, particularly to our lobbyist forms, in preparation for the new lobbyist registration biennium, which will start with 2023. We have the IT contractor available, and the staff is now submitting proposals or suggestions to various fixes to our forms to Ann Morgan, and we will sit down hopefully sometime in August to go over the proposals and then pass them along to the contractor to work on these fixes. Finally, again, the agency audit by state auditors for fiscal year 2020 and 2021 is ongoing, and it's so far it's going smoothly. So I don't know when they'll come out with a report, but that takes several months for them to generate one. And that's it on my report for this month.
Well, thank you for those updates, Peter, especially on the personnel front. Helpful. Any questions for Peter? All right, the next item on our agenda, you'll recall, as a matter of fact, Charles will probably remember well, we left him out in the hallway for a substantial period of time when last time and decided that we needed to have a discussion about the notification process involving SFI filers who leave state service. And so it came to our attention that once a state employee leaves state service, the only way they get the reminder to file their SFI if they leave mid-year is in their state email, which they no longer use or have access to. And I found that particularly problematic and thought it made sense to have a discussion, a further discussion about that. And so Peter or anyone in the office there who wants to add any information, background information, please feel free.
Sure. So I'll just give you a quick kind of process of notification that we go through, just a quick overview, and then we can discuss you know, what to do or any suggestions from the board will be welcome. So once we receive notifications from agencies that someone has departed a designated SFI position, we send the departing official a certified letter notifying them. And the letter is sent, we usually send it to the primary residence that we obtain, or the address, primary address that we obtain from the SFI filing. So Henry, in this case, Henry processes these letters. He sends the certified letters using the address that's available on the SFI form.
And again, when does that go, Peter? I'm sorry.
That goes out once we receive a notification from the agency. And that's where ethics liaisons are critical. Okay. That's when they inform us that so-and-so left state service, we then generate the notification. Exactly. We have 60 days right now under current language. We have 60 days to notify a departing official. So if ethics liaisons, and this happened just recently, and it's an ongoing issue, tell us, oh, so-and-so left on March 1st, well, the 60 days already passed. We can, at that point, we can only send a letter and ask them, you know, please, could you submit a, you know, you have no legal obligation necessarily. It's more asking them if they could submit, because they're not being notified within that 60-day window. Now, if we do, and we've received a number of notifications from ethics liaisons of the recent departures, especially the folks who've left on July 1st, Henry's working on those notifications as we speak, and they will certainly receive notifications within the 60-day window. And then they have 60 days to file, submit their departing official. Upon notification, they have 60 days to submit their SFI. Now, what happens in those situations where we sometimes some addresses, as you know, on the form, folks have an ability to not disclose their personal address because they claim exemption on their FOIA. because let's say their spouse happens to be a judge, or there's or works in the is a prosecutor. There are a few names that are listed under section 1-217 under FOIA. So if they claim exemption from disclosure, and we do not have any information other than their state email, we do try to contact human resources to obtain their private address so we can send the certified letter. But again, that assumes that we have timely notification from the agency that so-and-so has left state service. And that's the critical part. Getting timely notification from ethics liaisons, from agencies, so we can send out these letters. We do send out the newsletters to ethics liaisons, reminding them and also asking them to inform their agency leadership, their HR professionals, to be on top of it. I think the only way to do this, to fix this, and Brian brought up a suggestion in our staff meeting, is to remove the 60-day notification required for us to notify the outgoing official. They will still have 60 days to file, but kind of leave it open-ended in terms of how many days do we have to notify the official. So when an ethics liaison comes with a list of outgoing employees, and one person left on March 1st, another on April 1st, and then a bunch of them are July 1st. Oh, we lost them again?
Yeah. Well, we can still hear you. We can't see you.
All right, good. As long as you can hear me, I'm almost done here. You know, I think the best way to do it is to simply do a legislative fix and remove the 60-day notification requirement. And this way, if we do receive these late notifications, we can still inform folks of their obligation, and then they'll have 60 days to file the form. I think that's one way of dealing with it.
Peter, is it okay to talk about the facts or circumstances of what we talked about last time because it involved a specific matter, or is that not appropriate?
I think that that's appropriate because that's already been resolved, so yeah.
So as I recall the discussion we had last time, and please chime in, Mark, and let me know, this individual claimed that they hadn't received any notice either in the mail or via email, and it was because the email notice went to the state email address, which still didn't work. And am I recalling that correctly?
Is that Nakano, Mark?
There were a couple different matters. Do you recall? I know one of the matters I handled.
I don't remember the name. It was the only one that the board agreed to waive the penalty.
Okay, yeah, that was my matter, and she never received the notice of hearing via. She didn't get the notice regarding the SFI because she left state service, and it was sent to her email, so she never got that information.
Right, but what about that written letter that Peter was talking about? What happened with that?
So in this case, what I believe happened was she came up on our list as a part of like the regular role of SFI filer. So we didn't have notice that she had left. And to be honest, the main problem we have in our office, and I wouldn't call it a problem, but the main challenge that we have is that we rely upon liaisons and agencies to provide us that information. So right off the bat, for individuals who leave, a lot of times we either never get notification, or we get it 4, 5, 6 months later, and
right,
we can't act.
Right, so the suggestion that's been offered wouldn't address what we had in this last situation where the Office of State Ethics never got notice. This person was just picked up in the regular SFI process.
Right.
So
that's right. Yeah.
I think we need something that addresses that scenario.
Yeah. So what it would address by that, by a Peter's suggestion, is that it would give us more time, if we have more time, to revert back to the agency, or at least talk to the different agencies to remind them to come on and please submit, you know, people who have been, you know, either terminated or have retired. It's sort of like a little bit of a catch-all, but it doesn't, maybe it doesn't change the overall dynamic, which is us relying upon the information. It just gives us more time to notice them and to enforce, really.
So, I mean, I want to open this up to other board members. I was particularly concerned last time about the lack of any notice to that particular individual. And so just want to know how other folks feel about and about the proposed solution.
No, I have a question. When someone leaves a state's office, I would assume that there are forms that have to be filled out and checklists. Did we take them off the pension plan? Did we do this? Did we do that? Why don't we make sure that we're on that checklist? Is this person an SFI filer? Have we obtained a valid mailing address and a valid email address?
And that's, you know, that we do an outreach to ethics liaisons. And another conversation that has to be, you know, and we ask ethics liaisons to communicate with agency leadership and HR within their agencies to make sure that folks who are leaving are notified of their obligation to file. It's some agencies are very good about it. They do their job. Others are less so. And so that's another way of thinking, well, is there a way that we could maybe have a conversation with central HR office and impose some kind of a requirement that in your exit interview and the paperwork that you sign, you definitely have to sign paperwork about your pension, about your and your ID and many other things. Could we, for example, insert a document, some kind of an acknowledgement form that if you're an SFI filer, you acknowledge the obligation to file within 60 days, for example, of your departure?
But the lines that we need to have a valid email address and
oh, absolutely. That's another element.
And I know that when it comes to the SFIs, that OS, the Office of State Ethics, is very good about praising the legislative liaisons who get their work done in a timely fashion.
Yep.
We could there's no reason we couldn't publish a list of people who keep screwing up.
I mean, and you know, the newsletters, I, for example, will be sending another letter next week to ethics liaisons addressing the issue of temporary worker retirees, people who officially retired from state service, but been retained by respective agencies for 120 days because of transitional reasons. And these people, you know, the questions about, well, when do they file their SFIs? If they are designated as TWR employees, do they have to wait 120 days or can they do it now and so on? So that's going to be addressed next week in the email to ethics liaisons. So you could
use that as an edge. I mean, I'm hesitant to suggest a legislative fix. We all know how slow legislative fixes are. And it seems to me what Charles has asked is sort of the shortest distance between two points here. Can't we get this inserted somehow in that HR process, or is that just as difficult as a legislative fix?
I mean, one way of, it's worth checking, it's with central HR and having a conversation with DAS, because a central HR office falls under DAS commissioner. Is maybe having you know, some kind of a requirement. It has to be a policy decision, certainly, to have an acknowledgement form included in the exit interviews. So when people leave, they see that piece of paper, and at least they have to sign it when they sign up on many other forms.
And if HR, central HR, has a problem with it, you might point out all you're asking them to do is help us do our job to enforce the law.
Yeah.
Am I missing something? Is there a paper that should be generated? Oh, you guys are frozen. Oh. That, you're very still.
We can hear you. Frozen.
Okay. As long as you can hear, because you're frozen. Is there a paper that could be generated from your office that would then be presented. So when the person is having their exit interview, it wouldn't be necessary for the agency to come up with something if you've already handed them something, and they can just give it to that employee who will be leaving. I'm trying to make it so it's easy for the people who are doing that exit interview, that there's not another piece of paper or work that they have to do. Whoops. And now you're gone.
But we can hear you.
Oh, they can hear us. Good.
Okay. Well, I mean, maybe I've got this wrong, but it seems like something has to be generated. And the idea of giving it to the individual when they are about to depart, you know they've received it. So there's a paper trail. And then that's something, yes, you have to complete this within X amount of time. But then your office, ethics, is then notified that, yes, they have received it. Is that a possibility? Am I going off too far?
I think that's what we're talking about, Cheryl. And I think that, so I think you're right on. I think what I hear you suggesting is that certified letter that Peter was talking about, why don't we generate that and put it in the HR
correct
packet?
Yes.
So that we don't need someone to tell, it just becomes sort of the normal course.
Correct.
Is that sort of what you were getting at too, Charles? And
standardize it. Everybody who's got an exit interview, and there's a line, if they're SFI filer, they have to then fill in these information.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing. I mean, ethics liaisons still have to be involved because they have to make sure that their designation lists are up to date. For example, this past year, I think the state workforce has seen 4,000 or about 4,000 retirements. Not all among the 4,000 are SFI filers, obviously, but there is a number, a good number of them. And I think one way to capture these folks is probably to have a generic acknowledgement that, hey, if you are the SFI filer, may not be, but if you are, you have that obligation and you sign up.
And Cheryl, your idea is a good idea, but remember, they're finding out after the fact that these people have gone. So it's pretty hard for them to generate a piece of paper to have on an exit interview when that person's already left state.
I think she was talking about just a standard notification letter that
correct
isn't specifically addressed.
Correct.
You know what? I wonder if maybe what we can do is, Peter, can we ask you and your folks to noodle on this a little more and maybe make some contact with DAS about what could be possible in terms of the exit interview process? And then maybe you can bring back some more suggestions next time. I think, I don't think there's anyone on the board who disagrees that we need to have a more solid notification process. We realize that it's not any of your fault that you're not getting the information you need, but we need to try to close this loop so we don't have more of those situations like we had last time. Does that sound like a good plan, that next month maybe you can come back with some?
Sure. I mean, I definitely can do an outreach to DAS. Actually, I'm meeting tomorrow with Chief Counsel on a separate issue. So I will broach the subject and maybe we can schedule with her a separate meeting to discuss this very issue. So
that sound good to everyone on the board? Anyone have any other suggestions? No. All right, hearing none. Okay, so then we'll pick this discussion up again next month. So that brings us to the public comment portion of the meeting. We'll remain silent for a moment and see if anyone from the public has any comment. Okay, hearing no public comment, we do not need either a closed or an executive session, so we just need a motion to adjourn. Thank you, Charles. Can I get a second? Michelle's waving. I think that's a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? This meeting is adjourned. Thank you, folks. We'll see you next month.
Stay well, everybody.
Bye.